Namaskaram. Today I'm going to be talking about the 15th paragraph of Nana. This paragraph consists of one long sentence and followed by three much shorter sentences. The subject of the main clause of the first sentence is Jibagal, which means jibas, sentient beings. What he says in the main clause is Jivagal tattam karmanucharam shestitu adangu kindrana. That means jivas move and subside. Move can mean exert or engage in activity, and subside, in other words, cease to be active, in accordance with their respective karmas. However, though the subject of this first sentence, the main sentence of the paragraph, is jivas, it's not actually what this paragraph is all about. What this paragraph is primarily about is about the nature of God and God's relationship, if you can call it a relationship with karma. Bhagavan is emphasizing God is not a doer. To put this in context, it's worth considering what else Bhagavan has said about God in this work, Nana. The first paragraph in which he mentions God is in the seventh paragraph. What he says in the seventh paragraph, in the first sentence, he says, Yatatamai ulladu atmasarupa mandre. What actually exists is only atmasarupa. Atmasarupa means the real nature of oneself. In other words, what we actually are, our own real nature, that alone is what actually exists. And then in the second sentence, he says, Jagajivishwaragal sipil velipol adil karpanigal. That means the world, soul, and God are karpanegal in it, like silver in a shell. Karpanegal means fabrications, imaginations, or mental creations. It can also mean illusions or illusory superimpositions. But the primary meaning is a mental fabrication. So here Bhagavan is saying that the world, soul, and God are mental fabrications. Viewed superficially, this could seem to imply that Bhagavan is completely dismissing God as just a mental fabrication. However, we need to understand this in context. He's not only saying that God is a mental fabrication, he's also saying the world is a mental fabrication, and the soul, the jiva, is also a mental fabrication. Jiva means ego. So long as we rise as ego, there seems to be a world and there seems to be God. So the world and God are as real as ego. However, what he means here by God is in many other contexts, Bhagavan said God is our own real nature. God is what we actually are. So how to understand this? What he's implying here is that is when we, what we actually are is what is called God. That is our own Atmasvarupa is itself God. Our own real nature is itself God. However, when we rise as ego, we limit ourselves as a small person consisting of body and mind. So we are thereby limited in time, in space, and so on. And as this limited entity that we seem to be, from the perspective of this limited, from the view of ego, God seems to be something other than ourselves. Why is that? God is the one infinite whole. So when we limit ourselves, we no longer experience ourselves as the one infinite whole. So we see our own infinite nature as if it was something other than ourselves. That is, it's in that sense that God as another, God as something other than ourselves, is a mental fabrication. And he goes on that in that seventh paragraph to say, these three appear simultaneously and disappear simultaneously. And then he says, Swarupa, Swarupa means our own real nature. Swarupa alone is the world. Swarupa alone is I. Swarupa alone is God. Everything is Shiva Swarupa. Here he's not saying that the world is what we actually are, or ego is what we actually are, or God is what we actually are. What he means here by saying Swarupa alone is the world, Swarupa alone is what appears as the world. Swarupa alone is what appears as ego. Swarupa alone is what appears as God, as if he were another. So all these three, as he said, they are like silver in a shell. If we see a shell, if there's a deposit of nacre on the shell, it gives the appearance of silver. That silver is just an appearance. It's not actually silver. It just looks like silver. So these three are just illusory appearances, mental creation. They don't actually exist. Bhagavan isn't here denying the reality of God. He's denying the appearance of, he's denying the God as he seems to us, God as if he was something other than ourselves, has any substantial reality. That is, God as something other than ourselves is no more real than ego. And likewise, world is no more real than ego. That is, God, the world, and God as if he was something else other than ourselves appear only in the view of ego. So this is the first mention of God. The next mention of God is, there's a very brief mention in the eighth paragraph, but the context in which Bhagavan refers to God in the eighth paragraph, it's not actually one of the original sentences of Nana. It's one of three sentences that were later interpolated, at least 10 years after Bhagavan wrote this essay version, and it wasn't part of his original answers to Shiv Prashantalai. There it is said, however, in sleep, even though the mind has ceased, the prana does not cease. It is arranged thus by the ordinance of God for the purpose of protecting the body, and so that people do not wonder whether the body has died. So here, this is a very just a passing mention of God, and as I say, it wasn't part of the original text. So the next sentence in which Bhagavan refers to God is in the 12th paragraph, in which he says, Kadavalam Guruvam Unmail Verala. God and Guru are in truth not different. And as he often said on other occasions, God, Guru, and Self are all one and the same. That is, it is our own Self who appears to us as God, as something other than ourselves, and who subsequently appears as Guru in order to tell us to turn within and know what we actually are. So God and Guru are not different. They are both, their real nature is our own real nature. And then the next mention of God is in the, very importantly, in the 13th paragraph. In the 13th paragraph is the paragraph where Bhagavan is talking about surrender. And in the first sentence of that paragraph, he says, Arma chintane tavira, vera chintane kalamba vadaku, satram idum kodamal, apmanishta paranai iripte, tanne isanaku alipadam. That is, being apmanishta, one who's firmly fixed or established as oneself, giving not even the slightest room to the rising of any thought other than apmachintana, which literally means thought of oneself, but implies self-attentiveness, alone is giving oneself to God. So in this paragraph, he's talking about surrendering ourselves to God. And in the next sentence, he says, even though one places whatever amount of burden upon God, that entire amount he will bear. And then in the third sentence, he says, since one Parameshwara Shakti, Ishwara is a word that means God, but it also means God as the ruler. So Parameshwara can mean the supreme power, Parameshwara Shakti, can mean the supreme power of God, or it can mean the supreme ruling power. But it amounts to the same. It amounts to the same. So here he also, in the third sentence, he's referring to God, and he says, since one Parameshwara Shakti is driving all karyas, instead of we also yielding to it, why to be perpetually thinking it is necessary to do like this, it's necessary to do like that? So here Bhagavan is implying that it is God who is driving all karyas. Karyas in this context means whatever needs to happen or ought to happen, and whatever needs to be done or ought to be done, he's making it all happen. So this may give the impression that God is a doer, that God is doing actions. And indeed, God is often referred to in Vedantic and other texts as the Mahakata, the great doer. And even in the first verse of Upadesha Undia, for example, Bhagavan uses the word Katan, which is a Tamil form of the Sanskrit word Kata, the doer, as a term referring to God. There he says, action giving fruit is by the ordainment of Kata, God. So he's referring to God here as the doer. And likewise, in the Sanskrit version of that verse, Kataragnya prapyade palam, the fruit of action is by the ordainment of God, or the achieving, getting the fruit of action is by the ordainment of God. So in both the Sanskrit and both in the Tamil original and in the Sanskrit translation, Bhagavan refers to God as Kata. So this, but in this paragraph, in this 15th paragraph, Bhagavan goes more deeply into this role of God as the doer. And he reveals that though God seems to us to be a doer, he is not actually doing anything. That is the main message of this 15th paragraph. So this is what he's teaching us here in this 15th paragraph. It is a very deep idea, a very deep truth, and it puts a lot of other teachings in perspective. We need to understand, when God is said to be the doer, in what sense is he the doer? Bhagavan makes it clear here. So that's all a prelude, just to put this paragraph in context. So, as I say, in the 13th paragraph, Bhagavan said that one Parameshwara Shakti is driving all karyas. He's making whatever needs to happen, he's making it happen. So does that mean God is the doer? This is what Bhagavan is answering here. As I said, this paragraph consists of one long sentence and three shorter sentences. The long sentence I have split into two, because the first half is an analogy and the second half is the main part of the sentence. So just for explaining the meaning of the sentence, it's easier to split it in two. So the analogy that Bhagavan gives is in the first part of the sentence. What he begins by saying is, Icha Sangopa Yatnam Indri Erunda Aditan Sanadi Matritil. That means, in the mere presence of the sun, which rose without Icha, Sangopa, or Yatna. Icha means liking or wish. Sangalpa means desire or volition or intention. And yatna means effort. All these words are very closely connected in meaning, but I will explain a little bit more about them afterwards. But I'll first The order in which Bhagavan, the fact that Bhagavan chose to use all three words and he used them in this particular order is quite significant. So I will explain about that shortly, but I'll first put it all in context by reading the whole sentence. So in the mere presence of God, in the mere presence of the sun, because this is the analogy, in the mere presence of the sun, which rose without liking, desire, or effort, what happens in the mere presence of the sun? He goes on to say, Kantakal Agni Kakubadam. That means, Kantakal is a Tamil word referring to a Sanskrit term, Suryakanta. Suryakanta is a sunstone. It's a gem that is supposed to emit fire or heat when exposed to the sun. So just like that, Kantakal, Suryakanta, emits fire in the presence of the sun. Everything that he describes in this clause is what is happening in the presence of the sun. Tamare malavadum, lotus blossoming, near vatruvadum, water evaporating, ulahor tattam kariyangalil, Privititu, ear tree, Adangu Vadum. That means, Ulahor means people of the world. Commencing means Privititu. Ear tree, doing, and Adangi, ceasing or subsiding. So the people of the world, they engage in action, they do the actions, and they cease doing the actions. All this is in the presence of the sun. And then one last thing he says, that's one analogy. Then he gives another analogy. Kantatin mun usi shesti padam. And just like in the presence, in front of a magnet, a needle moving, so there are actually two analogies here. One is all the things that happen in the mere presence of the sun, and the other is what happens in front of a magnet, a needle moves. So all these things are, these two analogies is illustrating the nature of God, as it becomes clear in the remaining part of the sentence, the main part of the sentence. So up to here, Bhagavan has given us two analogies. In the main part of the sentence, as I said, the actual main clause is jivagal tattam kamanushan anucharam shestitu adangu kindrana, which means jivas move and subside in accordance with their respective karmas. But then there's a long relative clause describing jivas. That is, jivas, what Bhagavan says in the relative clause is sangalpa rahita tarai irakum isan sannidana visesha matratal nadakum mutoril aladu pancha krityango ku utpatta jivagal. That is, jivas who are subject to or ensnared in mutoril or panchakrityas. Mutoril means, it's a Tamil term, means three functions. This is referring to the three functions of God, the two basic functions of God, namely creation, sustenance, and dissolution. Or panchakrityas. But panchakrityas is a Sanskrit term that refers to five functions of God, namely these three, creation, sustenance, and dissolution, and also concealment, tirodhana, and grace. I'll explain a bit more about these afterwards. But what the important thing, the key part of this sentence is Sankalpa Rahitarai Irukum Isan Sanidana Visesha Matratal. All these things, that all these five divine functions, they happen by just the special nature of the presence of God. Isan Sanidana means the presence of God. Visesha means means what special. So the special nature of the presence of God, matrata, by the mere special presence of the nature of the presence of God, all these things happen. Just like everything, just like all the activities that happen on earth in the presence of the sun when the sun rises, and just like the needle moving in front of a magnet, all these five divine functions of creation, sustenance, dissolution, concealment, and grace, all these happen by the mere special nature of the presence of God. In other words, what Bhagavan is implying here is that God is not actually doing anything. Just like the sun is not doing anything, it is just, but in the mere presence of the sun, so many things happen on earth, and the magnet is not doing anything, but in the presence of the magnet, the needle moves. All the actions that we that jivas do happen, the five divine functions, creation, sustenance, dissolution, concealment, and grace, these happen without God actually doing anything. They happen by the special nature of his presence. What does Bhagavan mean here by the presence of God? The presence of God is God's being, God's existence. By his mere being, everything is happening. So what Bhagavan implies here is that God is not actually a doer. Though he is formally described as a great doer, because everything happens in his presence, he is not actually a doer. He is, the nature of God is mere being. And whatever God, being means existence, whatever seems to exist, the existence is only God. That is, God is the existence of all things. So he's the very being of everything. So nothing can happen without existence, without being. There must be existence in order for action to occur. Action is not the reality. The reality is just being, just existence. But when we rise as ego, we limit ourselves, and therefore we seem to become engaged in action. So what appears to us as action is actually nothing but the mere being of God. And God is nothing but our own real nature. God is what we actually are. So here Bhagavan is implying that God doesn't actually do anything, but all these five functions that are usually attributed to God, namely creation, sustenance, dissolution, concealment, and grace, all these happen by his mere presence. He's not actually doing anything. It's in his mere, by the special nature of his presence, all these things happen. Just to explain these Panchakrityas in a little bit more detail, creation. This is something we're all familiar with. Everyone, the general belief in all theistic religions is that God is the creator. The whole world has been created by God. But not only does God create the world, he also sustains the world. And eventually he will bring about the dissolution of the world. That is, since the world is created, it has come into existence. Whatever comes into existence also has to cease to exist. So not only does God create the world and sustain the world, but eventually he will dissolve the world. Those are the three basic functions of God, but two other functions are mentioned, concealment and grace. The word for concealment is tirodhana. What that means is, that concealment can be understood at different levels, but the basic concealment is that we are ignorant of our own real nature. If we as jivas were not ignorant of our real nature, none of these divine functions could appear to take place, because they all appeared to take place only in the view of Jiva. It's only in the view of Jiva there's a world, and therefore we look for an explanation. We say, oh, it must have been created, and how did it come into existence? And then there are so many different ideas. That is, science has its own theories, the most popular of which nowadays is the Big Bang theory, but there are alternative theories in science. Religions have so many explanations. In Genesis, it is said that God created the world in 7 days. In other texts, it is slightly different explanations are given. In Hinduism, there are many different explanations given of a creation. It is Brahma created all this from his mind, or Vishnu, sleeping on Adi Sesha, dreamt all this. This is all a dream of Vishnu. There are so many different explanations given. But one thing that is common with all these explanations, God creates everything from his own mind, or by merely saying. In the Bible, it's not stressed so much that God merely created these things from his mind, but it is said, God said, let this happen, and it happened. So that implies it's by God's mind. So all these various creation theories are pointing at the fact that the world is nothing but mental creation. But instead of saying outright that it's our own mental creation, as Bhagavan has taught us, for people who are not yet mature enough to understand and apply such teachings in an appropriate manner, it is said, God, some power other than ourselves, some supreme power has created this. But he's created only from his own mind. It is not, he's not created it from anything else. It's all a mental creation. So, as I said, these are I was explaining concealment. So, in order for these first three functions, creation, sustenance, and dissolution, to occur, since they occur only in the view of Jiva, and since they couldn't occur if we knew what we actually are, we wouldn't mistake ourselves to be a jiva. We would just remain as pure awareness, and as such, we would not be aware of any creation, sustenance, or dissolution. We'd not be aware of the existence of the world at all. It's only when we rise as ego, and we couldn't rise as ego, since ego is a false awareness of ourself. Awareness of ourself is something other than what we actually are. Now instead of being aware of ourselves as just I am, we're aware of ourselves as I am this person. So this is a false awareness of ourself. This false awareness of ourself doesn't completely conceal what we actually are. That is, even when we're aware I am this person, we are still aware I am. The awareness I am without any adjuncts is our real nature. But when adjuncts are mixed with this fundamental awareness I am, and we mixed and conflated with this fundamental awareness I am, we seem to be something other than what we actually are. So this self-ignorance is what is referred to as concealment. This word concealment is also used, an extension of this same idea of concealment. For example, it is sometimes asked, why don't we know our previous births? If we've had so many births, why don't we remember our previous births? And the answer given for that, even Bhagavan gave this answer. He said, it is by the grace of God that the past is concealed from us. Even the few bad things that we've done in this lifetime cause us so much mental anguish. If we knew all the wrong things that we had done in so many bad previous lifetimes, all the wrongs we had done to others, and all the wrongs others had done to us, it would be mental torture for us. So forgetting all our previous lives is a great blessing. So that is a secondary meaning of the term concealment in this context. But the primary meaning is our self-ignorance. So in order to enable all this to happen, we need to be concealed by ignorance, by avidya, ajnana. So Who provides that ajnana? It is God. Even our ignorance is attributed to God. And then the final and most important of all the five functions of God is anugraha, grace. What is grace? Grace is that power that removes the concealment and thereby brings an end to the whole appearance of all the panchakritiyas. Because all the other four kritiyas can seem to occur only in when there's that self-ignorance. So that concealment is necessary to enable these other functions to happen. And grace is that function of God that removes this concealment, removes this ignorance, and thereby enables us to be aware of ourselves as we actually are. So in other words, this idea of panchakritiyas, as Bhagavan said in the 13th paragraph, since one Parameshwara Shakti is driving all karyas, this is what he's referring to here. All these karyas, the creation, the sustenance, and the destruction of the world, the veiling of ignorance, and the removal of that veiling by grace, all these are happening by that one Parameshwara Shakti. They're all being driven by that one Parameshwara Shakti. But that one though that one Parameshwara Shakti is driving all these karyas, it is not actually doing anything. It is by its mere presence, by the special nature of the presence of God, all these things are happening. That's what Bhagavan is emphasizing here. So, for example, it is said, Bhagavan has taught us that as he says in the first paragraph, first verse of Upadesha Undia, action giving fruit is by the ordainment of God. That means when we do any karma, a karma here means agamya, the action that we do under the sway of our own vasanas, or in other words, according to our own will, those actions bear fruit. But those actions don't bear fruit of their own accord, because actions are jada, as he says in that verse. So once we've done an action, the fruit of that action is entirely in the hands of God. When, where, how, and whether we are to experience that is decided by God. So the fruits of all the actions we do get stored in what is called sancitta. Sancitta just means a heap or a pile. Because as a general rule, in every lifetime, we do many more karmas, we do much more agamya than we have time to experience the fruit of past agamya. So we are the fruit that is yet waiting for us to experience is increasing lifetime by lifetime, as a general rule. Of course, when we become more spiritually mature and begin to follow the path of surrender, then the speed at which we are doing agamya and thereby creating fruit is reduced. It loses its momentum. But still, from past life, there's innumerable fruits of actions that we've done in the past that we haven't yet experienced. So all those unexperienced fruit waiting to be experienced, are stored in what is called sanchitta. And from sanchitta, God selects which fruit we should experience in each lifetime. So that is the fruit that we are to experience in our present lifetime is what is called prarabdha, fate or destiny. So that is ordained or allotted to us by God. So if we consider all these things, when we see this world, the world seems to be full of numerous jivas. That is, there are at the present time, there's said to be about 7 billion people in this world. But the people means human people. But these are not the only jivas in this world. All the different animals are jivas. And not only in this world, in heaven and in hell, there are so many other jivas. So jivas are innumerable. And God is allotting the appropriate fruit of past actions for each and every jiva. This is why God is called the Mahakata, the great doer. He's got a huge amount of work to do. So if we take all these things literally, it sounds like, oh, poor God, he's got a huge amount of work to do. But actually, all these things happen by his mere presence. God doesn't actually do anything. By his mere presence, all these things happen. And how do they happen? They happen perfectly. Because so long as God seems to us to be something other than ourselves, we are finite, God is infinite. So since God is infinite, he has infinite knowledge, infinite power, and infinite love. So because he knows everything, nothing can happen without his knowledge. Because because he's all powerful, nothing can happen without his consent. But since he knows everything, if something happens, that is because he's allowed it to happen. And since he's all love, he has infinite love. He loves everyone, every jiva he loves as himself. Whatever happens by his will is for the good of all concerned. And therefore, everything is happening just as it should happen. So when Bhagavan refers to the special nature of the presence of God is primarily his being. But Satchidananda, being, awareness, and happiness, or Asti Bhati Priyam, being, shining means awareness, and Priyam, love, these are all one and the same thing. So God's being is itself his love. So it is God's infinite love that God has for each of us that manifests in our life as grace. So whatever is happening, and including all the creation, sustenance, dissolution, the veiling and the grace, allotment of the fruits of our past actions, all these are happening by the mere presence of God, because the presence of God is itself infinite love. That is, his very nature is love. So whatever happens, it's all happening for the good. But he is not doing anything. All, as Bhagavan says, by his mere presence, jivas who are subject to or ensnared in these panchakritiyas, who are what is affected by all these panchakritiyas, jivas do their, according to their own respective karmas, they act and they cease to act. So all our actions, we are the doer of the actions, but we couldn't be doing these actions without the presence of God. And because we are the doer of actions, we have to experience the resulting fruit. As Bhagavan says in verse 38 of Uludunapadu, Vine mudal namayin, vile payan tui poem. If we are the doer of actions, we will experience the resulting fruit. The converse of this is, so long as we are experiencing the resulting fruit, we were the doer of the actions whose fruit these, so everything that we are now experiencing is the fruit of actions that we have done in the past. So it is we who are doing, but we couldn't be doing any of these things if it were not for the mere presence of God. So everything is happening by his mere presence. Our doing is futile because whatever happens is happening according to his will. That is, our prarabdha has been allotted to us. It is a selection of the fruit of our past actions. But we've done so many actions in the past. Why has he allotted these particular fruit for us to experience in this lifetime? That is because these fruit are what is most beneficial for our spiritual progress. So whatever is happening, it's happening by the mere presence of God. In other words, by his infinite love, everything is happening. But the it is because of we are the doers of that is, we are the doers of karma, and we are acting. Bhagavan says here, we are acting karma anusancharam. That means anusaram. Anusaram means following our karmas. Here, in accordance with or following our karmas, it doesn't mean only the prarabdha karma. The prarabdha karma is the destiny, but it's also our actions are primarily driven by our karma vasanas. Karma vasanas means our inclinations to act, to think, speak, and act in particular ways. So if these vasanas that cause us to engage in action, and as a result of the actions we do under the influence of our vasanas, by being under the sway of our vasanas, that we thereby do actions and therefore experience the resulting fruit. That is why in the second verse of Upadesha Undia, Bhagavan says, Vinayin Vilevu Vilevatru, the fruit of action perishing is what it literally means. What that implies is the fruit of any action will perish. That is, if we do an action, the fruit of that action gets stored in Sanchitta. From Sanchitta, so long as it's there in Sanchitta, we're not going to experience it. But if it is the will of God, at some point, that fruit will be chosen for us to experience as part of our prarabdha. As soon as we experience the fruit of any action, that fruit had thereby perished. It's just like if you eat a fruit, let's say a grape or a mango or an orange or an apple or something, as soon as you eat that fruit, the fruit has perished. You can't eat the same fruit twice. Likewise with the fruits of actions. When we experience the fruit of an action, that fruit is thereby finished. It perishes. So that's just a adverbial clause. The main part of this sentence is vittai vinay kadal vitidam. As seed causes us to fall in the ocean of action, this, what Bhagavan refers to here as seed is the vasanas. So what he's implying in this first sentence of verse 2 of Upadesha Undia is what causes us to fall in the great ocean of action are these seeds, the vasanas. In the Sanskrit version of this verse, Bhagavan simply says, kriti mahodado patana karanam. He simply said the cause for falling in the great ocean of action. Because he wrote the Sanskrit in a shorter meter, he wasn't actually able to specify what that cause is. But in Tamil, he makes it clear what is the cause, it's the seed. And in the Malayalam version of Upadesha Undia, which Bhagavan wrote in a longer meter, anyone who understands Vedanta will understand when we're talking about seeds, it's talking about vasanas or samskaras. Bhagavan specifies that in the Malayalam version, where he says, I think, vasanakara vittai. That means the seeds in the form of vasanas. So it's the vasanas of the seeds that cause us to fall in the great ocean of action. So when he says here that karma anusaram, in accordance with karma, he's not just meaning that we are acting according to our prarabdha. Prarabdha is primarily what we have to experience. In order for us to experience what we have to experience, there are certain actions we have to do. Those actions will be made to do by God. That's what Bhagavan says in the first sentence of the note that he wrote for his mother. But avarava prarabdha prakaram adhikarnavan angangirindu artavipan. According to the prarabdha of each one, he who is for that, that's referring to God, or Guru, Bhagavan in other words, Angang Girundu, being there, there, means being in the heart of each one of them. That is, he's present in everything. That is what he refers to here, that Angang Girundu is what he refers to in this sentence as Isan Sanidana Visesha Matrita, by the mere special nature of his presence. So by, just by being in our heart, Atavipan, he makes us act. So whatever actions need to be done by our mind, speech, and body, in order for us to experience Prarabdha, will be made to do. But while we are experiencing Prarabdha, we are not just keeping quiet. We have so many likes, dislikes, desires, attachments, and so on. And under the sway of all these likes, dislikes, desires, and attachments, in other words, under the sway of the vasanas that give rise to them, we do so many fresh actions. Those fresh actions that we do under the sway of our vasanas are what are called agamya. It's the agamya that creates fruit. So this, in this one word, karma anusaram, Bhagavan is actually implying so much. He's referring not only to the actions that we are made to do in accordance with destiny, but those actions that we do under the sway of our vasanas. So those vasanas dispose us to act in, dispose us to make effort to experience pleasant things and to avoid experiencing unpleasant things. So, I mean, it is the nature of ego. So long as we rise as ego, we will always have vasanas to a greater or lesser extent. Vasanas means, Bhagavan classified vasanas into two kinds. Satvasana and Vishayavasana. Satvasana means the inclination just to be. That is the, it is that Satvasana is what will save us, because we need to have that great love just to be as we actually are, to know and to be what we actually are. That is Satvasana. All other vasanas are Vishayavasanas. Vishaya means phenomena, any objects or phenomena. So our inclination to experience anything other than ourselves is a Vishaya Vasana. So what is the connection between the Vishaya Vasanas and the Karma Vasanas? The Vishaya Vasanas are expressed in the form of Karma Vasanas. If I have an inclination to eat chocolate, I will have also have an inclination to get up and go to a shop and buy chocolate. So lying within every karma vasana is a vishaya vasana, because what motivates us to do actions is the the inclination to experience the vishayas. If we had no vishaya vasanas, we'd have no inclination to do anything. These vasanas are the real problem. And of course, whose vasanas are they? They are ego's problem. So the root of the vasanas is ego, and vasanas in turn are the cause of everything else. I said at the beginning of this sentence, I would say something more about the first three words Bhagavan uses in this sentence, Icha, Sangalpa, Yatnam. Bhagavan uses them referring to the sun. He's using them in the analogy. The sun has no liking, it has got no desire, and it makes no effort. But in its mere presence, everything happens. So that analogy is an analogy for God. What Bhagavan says about God is Sangalpa Rahita Rayirukum, Isan. God who is Sangalpa Rahita, that means one who is devoid of any desire or volition or intention. When Bhagavan says that he's devoid of Sangalpa, the implication in this context is that he's devoid of Icha, Sangalpa, and Yatna, all three. He's devoid of the liking, the desire, and the effort. Why did Bhagavan use these three words, and what is the significance of them? That is, all the efforts we make as a jiva are driven by desire. And desires arise out of liking. That is, first we see something, or we come to know of something, and we like it. we can like something without necessarily desiring it. I like the iPhone 12, but I've got my iPhone 10, so I'm quite happy with that. I've got no particular desire for that iPhone 12, though I can see it's something very nice. I like it. So likes don't necessarily give rise to desires. But if we dwell more and more upon a liking, I have a liking for iPhone 12 now. I see all my friends have an iPhone 12. I've only got an iPhone 11 or 10 or 9 or whatever. So slow, by dwelling on that liking, that the liking then sprouts into a desire. And the desire then means, oh, I want this phone. So how can I get this phone? I don't have enough money for it. So I have to make effort to earn the money, to save up money, to buy this latest iPhone. So liking gives rise to desire, and desire gives rise to effort. So it's very significant that Bhagavan used all these three terms here, and he used them in this particular order, because it's the likings that give rise to desires and the desires that give rise to efforts. As I said, he uses these terms to refer as adjectives, that is, he said the sun rises, he uses them in adverbial sense, because he says the sun rises without these three. That implies that God is devoid of all these three, liking, sangalpa, and that liking, desire, and effort. But there's also there's a further implication of this here, that is, who is the one who is doing all the actions, who is acting in accordance with prarabdha and their karma vasanas? It is the jivas. And what impels jivas to act? It is icha, sangalpa, and yatna. So there's a lot of, when we read what Bhagavan has written, we need to think very deeply about, not only about the meaning of what he's saying, but about the implication of what he's saying. So it is, as he says in verse 2, the cause for our falling in the ocean of action is the seeds, the vasanas. The vasanas are what, when a vasana sprouts, the first form in which it sprouts is as a like or dislike. And those likes and dislikes give rise to desire and aversion. And the desires and aversion give rise to efforts. We try to achieve what we desire and to avoid what we have an aversion for, what we dislike. So Bhagavan is giving us a lot of very deep clues here about the nature of action, how we get entangled in action. As he says in that second verse, it is what causes to fall in the ocean of action are our vasanas. But vasanas, what are vasanas? Vasanas are inclinations. We are not bound by our vasanas. That is, I may have an inclination to eat chocolate, but that doesn't mean I have to eat chocolate. I can either allow myself to be swayed by that inclination, and thereby let that inclination grow into a liking and grow into a desire and grow into an effort to achieve, to get some chocolate. Or I can, at any stage in the process of development, from the vasana to the icha to the sangalpa to the yatna, in any stage in this process of development, I can decide, no, I'm not going to be swayed by this. Yes, I've got a very strong desire to eat chocolate, but I'm not going to eat chocolate today. So we as Bhagavan says in several places in Nana, for example, in the eighth paragraph, when he talks about, I think it's the third sentence, he says, pranayam talum. Manam, by prana, even by pranayama, the mind will subside. And then he says in the next sentence, anal pranan adangi irakum varayil manamum adangi irandu. So long as the prana remains subsided, the mind will remain subsided. Pranan velipadum podu, when the prana comes out, in other words, when the prana becomes active again, Tanum, that means Tanum is referring to the mind will also come out, Velipattu, Vasane Vayatal Alayam. Under the sway of its vasanas, it will wander. So when we allow our mind to come out, to move away from ourselves towards other things, it wanders under the sway of its vasanas. Even our allowing our attention to move away from ourselves towards anything else, that is under the sway of vasanas. It's under the sway of vasanas that we even begin to attend to anything other than ourselves. And likewise, in the 19th paragraph of Nana, he says, there are not two minds, namely a good mind and a bad mind. In other words, what he implies there, there are not two types of mind, good minds and bad mind. Manamandre, mind is only one. Vasane gale subham indram, asubham indram, arendu vidam. Only vasanas are of two kinds, namely subha and asubha. Subha means they're agreeable, good, virtuous, or whatever. Asubha means disagreeable, wicked, harmful, bad. And then he says, manam subha vasane vayatai nikampodu. When the mind is under the sway of subha vasanas, nala manam indram, it is said to be a good mind. Asubha vasane vayatai nikampodu ketamanam indram solapadam. So when it is under the sway of asubha vasanas, it's said to be a bad mind. So in both these places, Bhagavan is indicating that all the movements of our mind, and not only the movements of our mind, but our behavior, it's when under the sway of our vasana that we do actions by mind, speech, and body, the implication. So, and it's because under the sway of our vasana that we do actions, those actions are agamya, and that is what, and the more we do any action, supposing today, till now I've been restraining my inclination to eat chocolate, but today I'm going to eat chocolate. I decide to eat chocolate. And if I, because today I feel inclined, tomorrow the inclination will be a bit stronger. So tomorrow I'll say, okay, let me just eat chocolate for one more day. And the next day it'll be stronger. The more we allow ourselves to be swayed by our vasanas, the stronger those vasanas become. The more we refrain from being swayed by those vasanas, the more we avoid being swayed by vasanas, the weaker the vasanas become. This is as Bhagavan explained in the 10th and 11th paragraphs of Nana, this is why the practice of self-investigation is so effective. Because when we are investigating ourselves, that is, when we are being self-attentive, we are trying to hold on to ourselves so firmly, but we don't allow our mind to be swayed by its vasanas. In other words, we don't allow our attention to go away towards any vishayas, anything other than ourselves. We hold on to self-attentiveness. Because we are, by holding on to self-attentiveness, we are refraining from being swayed by our vasanas. The more we do that, the weaker those vasanas become. But on the contrary, if we allow ourselves to be swayed by our vasanas, we are thereby strengthening the vasanas. So what Bhagavan talks about in this 15th paragraph, he's talking about the nature of God. But God is not a doer. The nature of God is just being. But in his mere presence, everything happens. But while explaining this, Bhagavan gives us so many clues to understand the nature of action. How do we become engaged in action? Because our vasanas give rise to the liking gives rise to the desire, and the desire gives rise to the effort. Icha, sankalpa, yatna. That's why he begins this paragraph with these three words. Icha, sankalpa, yatnam, indri. Indri means without. Erunda, aditan. The sun which rises without these three. So the reason why he applies these adjectives to why he said that the sun rises without these three, because he's using the sun here as an analogy for God. Likewise, just like the sun doesn't rise without liking, desire, or effort, likewise the magnet. The magnet just remains as it is, but in its mere presence, everything happens. The liking has got no, sorry, the magnet has no liking to attract the magnet. It's got no desire to attract them. Sorry, a magnet has no liking to attract the needle. It's got no, has no desire to attract the needle, and it makes no effort to attract the needle. But automatically in its presence, the needle moves. So likewise, God is without liking, desire, or effort. He's just mere being, but in his mere presence, all these things happen. And because he is not only being, but also love, love is his very being. So because he is all love, everything happens as it should happen. Because God is all love, what does God want for us? God, in the view of God, we are nothing other than himself. So he loves us as himself, and therefore he wants us to be happy as himself. So the ultimate aim of God, we talk about God's will, surrendering to God's will. What is God's will? Well, here Bhagavan implies God doesn't have any will. But if we are to attribute any will to God, the nature of God is infinite love. So God wants us all to be perfectly happy. And perfect happiness doesn't lie in the iPhone 12. It doesn't lie in the chocolate. It doesn't lie in anything in this world. As he said in the previous paragraph, the paragraph we spoke about last time, the 14th paragraph, there's not the slightest happiness of anything in any of the things of the world. It's due to our avivika, our lack of discrimination, our lack of clear judgment, that we think we get happiness from the things of the world. So Bhagavan wants us to be happy. So Bhagavan isn't going to cheat us by just giving us the petty pleasures of life. Bhagavan wants to give us infinite happiness. And infinite happiness, as he says in the first paragraph, in order to attain that happiness, which is one's own nature, tanne tan aridalvendam, oneself, knowing oneself, is necessary. So in order for us to achieve the happiness that we are all seeking, we need to know what we actually are. Why? Because that happiness is tansubhavamana chukate, that happiness is our own very nature. So in order to experience the infinite happiness that we actually are, we need to know what we actually are. So whatever happens in our life, whether it's seemingly good or seemingly bad, it's all happening by the will of God. And the will of God is that we should experience infinite happiness, which we can experience only by knowing ourselves as we actually are. So all the pleasures and pains that we undergo in life, whatever we experience according to our prara, in accordance with our prarabdha, it is all allotted to us by God with one aim and one aim alone, to mature us and thereby make us ready to come to this spiritual path, to follow this spiritual path, to investigate ourselves and thereby surrender ourselves completely to him. Why does he want us to surrender ourselves completely to him? Because only when we surrender ourselves completely will we be happy. So long as we rise as ego, we are not aware of ourselves as we actually are. So long as we're not aware of ourselves as we actually are, we're not experiencing the infinite happiness that we actually are. So we are permanently discontented. And nothing in this world can satisfy us. Dissatisfaction is our very nature. Whatever we may desire, nowadays, there are people in the world with hundreds of billions of dollars. Are they happy? No, they want more. Whatever we may desire, whether we want wealth or learning or friends and relatives or political power or whatever we may be, or we want our football team or cricket team to win the match or whatever it may be we're desiring. Why we desire that? Because we think if that is achieved, it will make me happy. But Bhagavan knows none of these things will satisfy us. Our cricket team or football team may win the match this week and we'll be happy, but next week it may lose and then we'll be unhappy again. Even before it loses, we'll be anxious. Or next time it's playing against against a very good team, will we win or will we lose? That anxiety is there. So this is all chitta chalana, the movements of the mind caused by our seeking happiness in things other than ourselves. In order to put an end to all the chitta chalana, all the movements of the mind, we need to turn our attention within to see what we actually are and thereby to surrender ourselves completely. So there's, as I say, there's what Bhagavan is revealing here is something very, very deep. And there's a lot of deep implication in what he's saying. He's revealing to us what is the true nature of God. Though God, in our view, God seems to be doing everything. God seems to have created this world, to be sustaining it, to be ordaining the fruits of our actions. And eventually, one day, he'll dissolve it all. And he's keeping us in ignorance because of our unwillingness to surrender ourselves to him. He's willing to remove the concealment at any time, but he's not going to remove that concealment until we are willing to give it up. We must be willing to give up our self-ignorance before God will remove it, because God will not force anything upon us. But he's all love, so he will do, but he will mature us and make us willing to give up this concealment. Then his grace will come in and remove this veil of concealment and reveal to us that it is that which is always shining in our heart as I. So as I say, there's so much deep meaning in this. One of the important messages in this first sentence is that God has no sangalpa. So in the next sentence, just to reiterate and emphasize this, he says, Andri, ava sangalpa sahita rala. Nevertheless, he, God, is not sangalpa sahita, the one who is connected with or who possesses any sangalpa. That is, he already said in the previous sentence in a relative clause that he is sangalpa rahita, one who is devoid of volition, but he reiterates it. God is not one who has any sangalpa. When he says he doesn't have any sangalpa, that implies he doesn't have any icha, sangalpa, or effort. So since he has no sangalpa, icha, or effort, since he has no icha, sangalpa, or yatna, no liking, desire, or effort, he doesn't actually do anything. So in the next sentence, the third sentence, Bhagavan says, oru karmamum avare otadu. Even one karma, one action, does not adhere to him. That implies that he's not bound or affected in any way by any karma whatsoever. In the presence of the sun, so many activities are happening on earth, but the sun is not thereby affected. In the presence of a magnet, so many needles may be moving, but the magnet isn't affected in any way. When he says not even one action adheres to him, it also implies he is not doing any action. Because as he said in the first sentence, everything that is happening, all the kariyas that he, in the 13th paragraph, he said he's driving all kariyas. But how is he driving all kariyas? Not by doing anything, but in his mere presence, all kariyas are automatically being driven. Because he is infinite love, everything is happening just as it should be happening for our benefit. For our benefit means our ultimate spiritual benefit. And then in the final sentence of this paragraph, he gives two analogies to illustrate what he says in this in the previous sentence, that one, not even a single karma attaches it, or adheres to him, attaches itself to him. He says, adu, that, meaning that that is not sticking to him, loka karmangal suryane otadadam. That is like the world actions not adhering to or affecting the sun. That is, the sun is unaffected by whatever happens in this world. That's one analogy. And then the other analogy he gives is Aniya Chaturbhudangal Gunagunangal Vyapakamana Ahayate Otadadum Polam. It is also like the qualities and defects of the other four elements, namely earth, water, air, and fire, not adhering to the all-pervading space. Just to illustrate what this means, supposing you have a jug of water. If you've got a jug of pure water, the space in that jug is not affected by the purity of that water. If it's dirty water, impure water, the space in the pot is not affected by that. That is, other elements are affected by pollution or by purity and impurity, and so many qualities the various elements have. They've got qualities of their own, and they mix up with the qualities of other things. So air has certain qualities, fire has certain qualities, and when air and fire join together, the fire rages all the more. And when fire combines with water, the water evaporates. When fire combines with earth, the earth becomes parched and dry, whereas when water is added to the earth becomes moist and fertile. So all these elements, they interact with each other. But all these are happening in space. The space is not in any way affected by any of these elements. So everything that is happening in this world is happening in the mere presence of God. That is, God is the presence in which everything is happening. Because since he is the one infinite whole, nothing can happen but in him. Everything is happening only in him. But he is not affected by any of these things, just like the all-pervading space is not affected by whatever it may contain or may not contain. The presence or the absence of other elements and the qualities or defects of those other elements do not affect it in the slightest. It remains unaffected by them. Likewise, God and karma. God is not in any way affected by whatever karmas may happen. All the karmas are happening by his mere presence, just like all the actions in the world are happening in the mere presence of the sun. But the sun is not affected by the actions that are happening on the world. The sun is not affected by the Suryakanta, the sunstone emitting fire. It's not affected by the blossoming of the lotus. It's not affected by the water evaporating. It's not affected by whatever actions we may engage in or do or stop. The sun remains unaffected. Likewise, God remains unaffected. So what is the nature of God? God is, as Bhagavan made clear elsewhere, God is Sat Chit Ananda. Pure being, pure awareness, pure happiness. Or to put it in other words, Asti, pure being, Bhakti, pure shining, pure awareness, Priyam, pure love. Because Ananda and love are inseparable. As Bhagavan says in the first paragraph of this, of Nana, Priyataku Sukhame Karanam Adalalam, since happiness alone is the cause of love. That is, we love what we think will make us happy. And when we get what we love, it makes us happy. So happiness, when we rise as ego, we see differences. So we now, it seems to us, but either happiness is causing love or love is causing happiness. That is, because I like this and I get it, then it makes me happy. Or because it makes me happy, therefore I like it. So and they seem to be two different things, but actually love and our real nature is itself infinite love and infinite happiness. So the nature of God is pure being, pure awareness, pure happiness, and pure love. He is not in any way, he doesn't do anything. That is, being doesn't do. It's only when we rise as ego that we get engaged in doing. So God is mere being. He doesn't actually do anything. But in his mere presence, everything happens. Because everything happens in whose view? Only in the view of ourself as ego. And we rise as ego. From where do we rise as ego? Only from that fundamental awareness I am. That fundamental awareness I am. That is our awareness of our own existence. That is Satchit. That Satchit is God. That Satchit is the presence of God. So without the presence of God, nothing could even seem to happen. But it all happens only in the view of ego. So if we want to experience God as he really is, we need to stop engaging in action. We need to turn within, thereby merge back into our source. When we merge back into our source, all action ceases and being alone remains. That being that remains when all action ceases, that is what Bhagavan refers to as the presence of God, the special nature of the presence of God. And then what is the special nature of that presence of God? It is pure awareness, pure happiness, and pure love. Om Namo Bhagavate Sri Arunachala Ramanaya.